Hey guys, this is John Bokenkamp, the creator of The Blacklist. You are listening to The Blacklist Exposed on Golden Spiral Media.
The man of many words joins us today. Welcome to the award-winning The Blacklist Exposed podcast. I'm Agent Troy Heinrichs.
And also the man of many, not quite answers. I'm Agent Aaron Peterson, and we're talking to series creator John Bokenkamp one last time for season 6. Show notes and our intel for this episode of The Blacklist Exposed can be found at theblacklistexposed.com.
I always sing that song from Hamilton, one last time.
Yeah, we're putting this baby to bed.
We are. Season 6 is over.
And people started hugging it out.
There was actually a really nice discussion thread that was going on about the Red Arena theory, and people were actually civil. So I think maybe our words of wisdom from last time actually are paying off.
I honestly believe Game of Thrones kind of just took over, and they just they had something else to be madder about.
That's very possible.
So that way, now we asked some good questions here, I think. So you may or may not get the answers you are looking for in this respective interview.
Just depends on how much John wants to dance, like he usually does.
Da-da-da-da-da-da. There's some good listener questions here. I know a bunch of you sent them in. We obviously couldn't pick them all, so we had to trim down the questions that we did ask, but we think we've got a nice helping or a selection of listener questions for John that you guys are going to enjoy.
Yeah, so why don't we just jump on into it? Here's John Bokenkamp closing up season 6 of The Blacklist. Well, guys, we're here with John Bokenkamp, creator of The Blacklist, and just super happy that you stopped by again because season 6, man, still going strong. You end up on a ratings high for the season. Haven't seen the DVR numbers yet from the finale, but I'm sure they're going to be great. What is it like 6 seasons in, John? We always talked about the firsts are always hard for you guys. This season seemed like you had each episode seemed really strong. The arcs seemed like they were a little bit weird at times. How did you feel about the season overall?
I felt good about it. Thanks for having me back. I felt good about the season. I think that when I look back at it, it's bananas. It's almost hard to remember that Red was in prison and on death row. Wow, that was this season? He was arrested while eating a pretzel and the UN was bombed. And so it was a big season. And I think that 6 seasons in, when budgets start to shrink and shows start to change, I'm really proud of the fact that I feel like I don't think the show feels like it's changed. I think it's still a big show. I think we have a lot of turns and twists and big character developments, you know, stuff with Tamar leaving and reveals about Red and who he is. And so I feel good about it. You know, as you had said, some of the plot lines, they can't all be gold, Troy. I am very curious about what you guys think worked and didn't work. John has said before, judge me not on a single episode, but on the life of the series, you know, is sort of a how I feel. That's the way I can defend anything that may not have worked for people this season. But I'll tell you what I am curious about. What I want to, if I can ask you guys the first question.
Oh, sure.
I'm curious about this, Aaron, which is about Liz and her turn in this season, because I know that was something you bumped on, which is a bummer, and I can't defend it that it was masterfully done, but the idea was that, you know, she starts off on the hunt, and at a certain point in the season pivots to almost forgiving Red or sort of being disinterested in the truth. And I heard you guys talking about that, and I was just curious to hear what about that didn't work, or what about that just felt disingenuous or not real?
I don't know if disingenuous, I wouldn't say that's the word, more of a struggle narratively for me to follow. I actually bought, for the most part, I totally understand where her rationale comes from. It's just, there were certain key moments where I felt like she should be asking questions that she didn't ask. And any rational person would ask questions in that moment. Death Row is definitely one that I can think of off the top of my head. But there were a couple moments where I'm like, just ask the question. We know we're not going to get the answer. We know we're not, but it helps keep the character real to us to know that she at least asked the question.
You should be a studio exec. You'd be great.
I have a lot of ideas.
Well, that's good. Well, I think that what we were aiming to do, at least in the break, was that she was hell-bent on getting answers in the beginning of the season. And that she overstepped in having him arrested and had no idea that it would come to this. The idea that he's put on death row and they're going to execute him. And she even has, I think it's episode 12, an opportunity to go see him. And she goes to see him specifically because she wants to ask, confront him. This is the last chance, I think she tells Wrestler, this is the last chance I might have to get to the truth. And when she gets there and when she sees him, this very powerful man in this very sort of weakened position, she just can't bring herself to ask it. It feels almost selfish to her to ask that question. And from that point on, she decides that it doesn't matter, that he cares about her and that his love for her is probably greater than anybody else that she's experienced in her life. And so she decides to look past it. The thing I would admit, and we do often say this, we had an experience very early on, probably season two, where we were at a meeting with NBC. We were pitching something to the team there. And Bob Greenblatt said to us, he said, I don't know, the thing, I guess it feels to me like the writing's showing. And I was like, ooh, what does that mean? The writing is showing. And maybe the writing was showing there a little bit. You know what I mean? Maybe it was a little, maybe you could see the construct of what we wanted to do. We wanted her to look, we wanted her to forgive, and we wanted her to be able to move on. And Wrestler was unable to move on and needed to still scratch that itch. And it might not have been handled deftly enough. And maybe you're just picking up on the fact that the writing was showing.
You did spin it into Wrestler then, because here's the guy who followed Red for 5 years as part of the task force before the show starts. Like, right. He's like, wait, there's answers. I can go get them now. Like, damn straight, I'm going to go get them. So I thought that was a great turn so that Diego could have something to play with on the back half. So I think it salvaged it. I think the biggest challenge for me was just the promo and the hype of the season was two sisters teaming up, going to take this guy down. And then it's like, they didn't do anything for four episodes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also, I think we were also, I don't know if this is the business side of it or what, but we were also trying to walk a fine line of getting there too soon, you know, and, sure. And I'm not saying we were trying to stretch it, but we knew that we couldn't go do just a story that was about Red in prison and sort of being Alan Shore. And we also couldn't do just the story of Liz and her quest with her sister. And so we made very early on the choice to commit to Fiona Dourif, who plays Jennifer, a certain number of episodes, and we decided to checkerboard them. And we thought maybe a nice way to balance it would be, let's do some sister investigation, and then let's in the next episode do a little bit more, lean heavier into the legal side of things. And then we'll come back and we'll do some more sister investigation. And because we made that choice, maybe that probably influenced, obviously it had to influence the way that those women reacted and how, you know, the pace at which they were sort of driving through this mystery. But part of that is we just had to make commitments to, when we bring somebody in like Fiona and we want her to be on the show, she's obviously working and has other stuff to do, whether it's her or Anna McMahon or the guy who played the president, Benito Martinez. We have to commit way ahead to say, oh, we'll have you in episode 17 and 21 and 22 and sort of write to that. So at times it's a little tricky. Again, that's indefensible. I'm not saying that's why the show should or should not work, but it is part of the practicality of making it that you have to go, all right, well, how are we going to spread this story out? And you sort of have to make a couple choices early on and write them out.
Let me ask you a question about Dom, because I've had this conversation and I know a lot of listeners have as well. The Ilya episode, we know Dom is an unreliable narrator, his words, not what we see on screen. But would you say that everything we actually see, physically see, occurs in some fashion? That you're not dodging the audience or fooling the audience or pulling the rug out or anything like that?
What I would say about that is that, and I think this holds true for other flashbacks or other stories that we've told within the show that might already be closed, but other open-ended questions. Yes, it is true that Dom could be an unreliable narrator. Yes, it's true he could be protecting Red or his daughter, but I think there's more truth in what he says than fiction. If what you're suggesting, Aaron, and I've heard you say this before, like, are the things that we saw in that story all no, we're not going to come back and sort of portray that everything he said was like a dream sequence in some bad student film. Like, oh, guess what? None of that really happened. It's not like that. I think there's more truth to it. Is it open to interpretation? Could it be open to the idea that, like you said, that maybe he's an unreliable narrator? Maybe. I mean, but Raymond Reddington's an unreliable narrator, and which he said in the pilot. So I don't know if that really answers that for you, but what it is not is just some big story that everything you saw was fake. Answer that, or am I dodging that?
I don't think you're dodging it. It was just it's very much because we've had this. I've had many people tell me that I can't consider what we saw canon, and I say I can't consider what Liz says canon. I can't consider what Dom says canon. But if I see it on the screen, and you've heard me say this, if I see it on screen, I should be able to take that as, even though you can probably twist because you don't see what happened before, you don't see what happened after. Maybe some names were changed to protect the guilty or something. But what we see, I would think, would be part of the show, would be a reliable canon that we just need more information to truly understand.
I think that's right. I think, if anything, is there a piece or two of it missing of that story? Maybe. But is that story more true than not? Yes. It's again, it's sort of like, I keep going back to this. It's the only one I think of, because in 6 years, my mind's gone to mush. But Are You My Father? No. Then we find out Raymond Reddington's her father. It sounds like we've contradicted ourselves. And then we find out that there's a DNA test. We find the bones of Raymond Reddington. And those three things, along the way, each of them were true. Sometimes there was a little bit of a contradiction to them. But in hindsight, it's one very clean story. Raymond Reddington's Elizabeth Keene's father. It's just that James Spader is not playing, you know, is not the original Raymond Reddington. So, yes, is there wiggle room, I suppose? But is it a big fake out? I don't think that's fair to the audience.
So we ended up the season, of course, with the big reveal. Katerina now out in the open. Or is it? I love the interviews that you guys gave after the thing where John's like, well, you know, Raymond is Raymond today. You know, anybody that would know Raymond today would call him Raymond, even though we know he's not Raymond Reddington, the original Raymond Reddington. So with that logic, you have to start to apply that logic. Also would technically apply to Katerina potentially, or you can just take it at face value and say, no, this is Katerina finally coming out of the cold.
Right. What are you getting at here, Troy?
I mean, you hurt my feelings, you know, if it's Katerina. It's like, we've been friends for 6 years.
I know. Heartbreak. Here's what I would say about that. I heard you guys saying something in the fact that I'm only going to answer, you know, well, but it is the Blacklist, so I don't know how I can answer that question. I somebody had asked me that. I can't remember who it was, but there was an interviewer who said, well, just because he calls her Katerina, do we believe that's Katerina? And I'm like, well, how do I answer that? That's a loaded question. You know, no matter what I say, I'm going to give something away.
So why Katerina now? Why introduce Katerina now? Why was this moment the right time to introduce Steve Martin's wife from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Okay. Thank you that is your reference point to Viola Roberts. I was, when casting sent over some ideas of who could play this part, and we were looking for somebody who could resemble, you know, sort of realistically Lotta Verbeek, I was like, she's great. And I looked at Viola Roberts' footage, and I was like, why do I know her? Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I watch it religiously every year.
Every Thanksgiving, right?
Every Thanksgiving. I'm telling you, every Thanksgiving. And my son's not old enough to watch even the one scene with all the F-bombs. So why now? I think that it just feels organic. The whole season we were teasing at and sort of learning about Katerina. We were asking questions about her, whether it's wrestler chasing her down or Dom and, you know, the story that he tells, or the people who are looking for her, the Russians. And we've been talking about her so much, and it just felt like it was time to bring her out of the woodwork and to see where she was and meet her. And not only to meet her, but to meet her in a surprising way. If it was just the hello or just the kiss, in fact, I even wondered about that. After I saw the cut, we were way over on time for this episode. And I was like, is there a way, where are we going to trim? Part of me thought, wow, it's Katerina coming out in Paris and this kiss. Is that enough? Maybe we just go out on that kiss. And we decided not to. I thought you could easily have done a direct pickup next season to see the this injection, by the way. It was an injection with a needle, a long needle, I admit. He was not stabbed. but he's been drugged. And I thought, well, do we even need that? You know, just the fact that she's coming out of the woodwork and meets him and he knows her and they recognize each other, maybe that's enough. But then to spin it with the idea that he's caught off guard and he's drugged and she drags him off in this van, that felt very Blacklist to me, in that not only are we hopefully stepping past the expectation that we actually meet her, but we're doing one more, which is we're meeting her in a way that brings with it an unexpected twist, that she actually drugs this guy that she's supposed to care about and has him sent away. So it just felt like the right time. Felt like we needed to meet her now. I think anything beyond this would be stretching it.
Some fans have asked why cast, and nothing against her performance or anything, just why cast a new actress versus Lada when you could, some people would say use makeup, but I think that's really expensive and hard to do, and even in today's environment, but yeah. I don't know the answer if that's the answer.
It is. It's hard to do. It's expensive. And it's the hardest thing about it is our time frame. When we move so quickly, we shoot these episodes in like 8 days, the virtue of trying to get somebody into makeup would be, it's just not realistic for us. And so there's that. And we have embraced the idea of using different actors to portray the same character. And Dom's a good example of that. How do you find somebody to play Brian Dennehy, a young version of Brian Dennehy? And we needed that in episode 19. And it felt like, well, sometimes we can cheat it. People could play younger versions of themselves. But it's just something where we, typically I would prefer the makeup. But it just felt like our show covers so much time. It's 30 years, basically, that we're going back and telling these stories. And so it just feels like, well, it's the only way to kind of do it in a realistic way that also is production friendly.
It's almost why I was 99% dead, 1% maybe still a lifeline there for the Red Arena camp right after the finale. Because for me, the number one thing that went in my head was, I want to see what happens when Red, Katarina, and Liz are all together face to face. What happens in that moment? That just seems so much more exciting than who is Red. I think you guys always said it from the beginning, we're asking the wrong questions. So I think that's more exciting. Right. Like, what does Katarina being here mean to Red? What does that mean to Red and the KGB? Does the KGB, I mean, there's just so much stuff that the show could maybe go into season 8, and then you guys can actually fill up the 44 spots on the Blacklist that are still open.
8? Oh my God. 8. I can barely think of 22. No, look, that is a relationship that is ready to be explored. There are big questions between her and Red. And you're right. I mean, what would Liz have to... Now, remember, at the end of the season, Liz has no idea that Red's been taken. She has no idea that he went to meet this woman or that he's been drugged and taken to wherever. And so Liz and the entire task force have some catching up to do. They probably won't be sitting down for a family dinner anytime real soon. But yeah, you're right. There's good mileage in Liz and Katarina and Red and wherever that story takes us. I think it's fresh and new, and that's what's exciting about it.
The biggest question everybody's going to have all summer, though, is can we take it at face value? I love how people were like, face.
Oh,
the imposter stuff.
Send me one of your t-shirts. Send me one of your t-shirts, right?
This is kind of an interesting question, or kind of the way I saw it, I guess. Throughout mm-hmm. the season, especially the back half of the season, like you said, there was a lot of talk about Katarina. She was definitely in the forefront, or the mm-hmm. backdrop, one of those, however you want to look at it. And as we approached the end of the season, and I told this to Troy many times, I think I talked about it on the podcast, but it felt like as we got close, especially like the last 4 or 5 episodes, it almost felt like there was an intentional rationalization of where our characters are and who they are in terms of putting some of the theories to bed. So kind of like reestablishing that here's where we are on their personal relationship between Liz and Red. They are parent, child, assimilated in some way. Here's where we are in terms of, like, just kind of like cushioning people for the blow to build up to Katarina. Am I just reading that completely wrong? Is that just fan fiction in my head, or was that
I don't think you're reading into that. I think that I think that's an effort to be definitive. You know, it's an effort to try to be clear. I think 619 was an episode where we really tried to give a story that made sense and answered a lot of questions. You can say that, well, maybe Dom fabricated the story or parts of the story, or what did we see that was a bait and switch, you know? But the truth is that the story works and it tracks. Now, again, and I don't mean just that story specifically, but with any of these sort of statements, I feel like they're usually more true than they're not. I feel like when we go back and undercut something, again, like Red saying, when Liz says, "Are you my father?" he says no. And then we find out that he is her father because of a DNA test. And then we find out because of the bones that he is not Raymond Reddington. All of those are true. They're all equally true.
Right.
It's just they feel, I can't tell how frustrating it is. Maybe it's just insanely frustrating and we should just be more clear. But I think we were this season trying to play very fair. We always try to play very fair with the audience, but we were trying to sort of situate these characters and really reset where they are, you know, on the parent child thing. You know, John says that often in interviews, and I sometimes get after him about it because it doesn't necessarily mean that that's what it is, a parent child relationship. What he means is that it is parent child baked into the DNA of their roles. He's a more experienced, seasoned, crazy bad guy. She started and is still, in comparison to him, learning and learning from him. And he has lots of advice and she takes. So, you know, it doesn't mean that he's her father or Troy, her mother, or, you know, and as parent child in that way, although it could mean that. But it does. That's not what John's saying. He's just saying that there's an inherent sort of parental nature that one is learning from the other. So to answer your question, that's a long answer, but to answer your question, yeah, we were trying to sort of land on some specifics about cementing and reaffirming who these people are and how they feel about each other.
So are you able to definitively put certain theory camps to bed or not? Just to be clear, because people are all like, well, she said Raymond at the end, so this has got to be Raymond Reddington, the original. No, he's dead. We've already covered that. Like Raymond Reddington, the original father of Elizabeth Keene, he is dead. So, right, Daddygate, maybe that's put to bed. Because maybe this person that is playing Red could still be Elizabeth's father. That's what other people are saying. And we're like, no, that's not it either, because we already proved the DNA test said that original Raymond Reddington is her father. So I think we can say Daddygate is in the ground. What about like Lizington or the mother theory? Or are there ones that you can definitely say, hey, you know, just to help out your summer and your rewatch, don't even look at these.
Look at him hoping and praying for any semblance of
hoping and praying. I love that. I love the hope. It gives me hope. Look, what would I say about that? Yeah, Raymond Reddington is dead. Now, the minute I say that, maybe that's a great alternate ending that we should embrace. I've heard some things that are interesting about that. And so, again, nobody knows anything, including myself. Maybe it's all rewritten with some great new idea at the very end. But yes, I think it is fair to say that those bones were the bones of Raymond Reddington. Raymond Reddington, the naval officer who disappeared 30 years ago. And the guy who, I thought the thing that Spader said in some interview, which was that sort of said it the best, is he said, they never would have made a TV show about that guy. They made a TV show about this guy.
Right.
And this guy who has stepped into this name and embodied a sort of a much more interesting character, that's who they made the TV show about. So I think that's fair. As far as the other camps, I don't know. I'm not going to put it, but this is where you guys get on me about saying, oh, he's not going to commit. I'm not going to commit to any of those. I'm not going to squash any of them. And I shouldn't, you know, I think that's what's cool about it. That's what's so fun about listening to the podcast and to reading the comment threads is seeing how it's interpreted, you know, because the interpretation is a big part of it. I do believe that. How people process the show and what they see is super interesting to me.
Boy, that was a nice dodge. There you go, Troy. You have a little bit of hope. None for me. I have zero
hope.
There's
a little dodge and a little hope for Troy, right?
That's like pity. That's what that was. That was a pity.
No, I don't think it's pity, but he's dead. I think that's fair to say.
How did it feel to say goodbye to Majan this year?
Oh, that's a great question. It was hard. I'm conflicted about it because Majan was, ultimately, this was her choice, right?
Right.
She came to us early in season 6. Look, she has other opportunities. She wanted to act in other stuff. She has since. She wants to direct. She's incredibly talented behind the camera as well. She has directed and written. And I think she just felt like it was time to try other stuff. And so we sort of, this is one of those things where I say, as much as we sort of lay out where we want to go, things happen in the storytelling and in the, that you sort of find it as you go along. And when she said that she wanted out, we thought, well, God, how are we going to do that? And how do we lose her and not have it feel like business?
Right.
And let her out of her contract to go do other great things. We were lucky that we had this story where she had been underwater, and one of our writers in the room has a father who has aphasia and goes through this sort of this crazy deep struggle with memory and sort of a version of dementia. And we thought, well, let's try to embrace that. Let's like lean into a more of a mystery of her and what's going on with her. And then let's try to really lean into the love story, which we're not good at doing. We're not a relationship show, but let's really lean into the Aram Samar story and bring them as close as we can and then break them up in the episode before we know she's going to have to leave so they can come back together. And when she leaves, it has to be as painful as possible for both of them. It's a bummer to have her gone. I love Mojan. She was great to the show, and I can't imagine it without her. And yet, just the necessity of needing to let her go, I think gave us a really great couple episodes. The episode where Aram punches Red and that she leaves, you know, she has to leave him because she loves him and it breaks her heart. I thought it was just great. That's when I say emotionally, sometimes the show can be really grounded and real. That's another episode where I felt so proud. I was like, wow, this is like a drama. This is a real, I'm with these people, you know, and the music was on point and the direction was on point and the characters were on point. So it's hard. I'm conflicted about it. She's great and I wish her nothing but the best, but it's hard to leave her. And yet it provided an opportunity for us to have a really unique and great story, knowing that she was going to leave. Typically that's a ripoff.
Right.
Well, let's pretend like she's going to be sick and then she won't be, you know, and she'll get cured and it'll be okay and they'll live happily ever after. But knowing that she was going to leave was a really unusual predicament, and thought that was a strong story.
Well, I got to tell you, for a series that is a large portion mythology and a large portion, you know, has a lot of great moments throughout 6 years, that's a series highlight for me.
I'm glad to hear you say that. It is for me too. I remember John Bissell, our music supervisor, who you guys have interviewed. He sent me a Love Like There's No Tomorrow is the song, but War and Treaty, I think, is the band. Anyway, they had this song, and I remember listening to it months before. He probably sent it to me at the beginning of the season. I had no idea where it would fit. And then as we're realizing what we're going to do and that she was going to have to leave, it's like, oh, wait, that's one of those where it sort of sits there and, you know, you forget about it and it comes back. And again, between the direction and the performances, that's where they make us look good.
Well, and it also gave you a little bit of a parallelism or a closure with Aram, with Amir, and Aram sitting there, especially at the end of season 5, they met holding hands in a hospital, mm-hmm. they get engaged holding hands in a hospital. I thought that was really great.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also have that same thing with Aram and Red in Aram's episode after Samar leaves the show. And you have this whole like, well, Red's holding Aram hostage. Tell me who's the routing number until I put this gun back together back in season 1. And now here you have the switch
mm-hmm.
where Aram's holding him hostage for $60 million to take him to go see his girlfriend.
Yeah, it is. And it's also seeing the character growth. I mean, what I think what's fun about it, you know, characters on TV aren't supposed to change, you know, like Barney Miller is Barney Miller or Seinfeld. You know, they're not supposed to really change. It's sort of a classic template. And what I think is great about it is while Aram hasn't changed through all of that, he's still insecure and funny and sort of fumbling and awkward at the impossible moments. He's also changed in incredible ways, you know, like going from that agent in that first season to who he is now. It is a big arc. And so, yes, there's parallelism throughout it. And, you know, those relationships have shifted. But in the beginning, when Red was putting that gun together, saying, here's how much time you have until I have put this gun together to get my money, he was terrified of Reddington. And the idea that he would come back and slug him like he did and take his money, I thought that was just a nice character growth, you know. And I thought Amir did a fantastic job. And so we tried to take what was a negative, obviously, with Mojan leaving, and try to really roll it into the show in the best way possible. And look, it's something we did when Megan was pregnant. We were like, well, we can hide this and we can just have her holding a plant the whole time and pretend like she never had a kid. But it's a show about an orphan, a kid who doesn't know where she comes from with Elizabeth Keen. And so how can we deny that? It's like the universe sort of saying, hey, here's an idea, work this in somehow. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but I find it's better to embrace those sort of real life obstacles. And we do it week to week, you know, in terms of what's producible, what we can show, what we can blow up. All that stuff is that's how it's very loose in terms of the show we make. And we have to be very nimble, both in the storytelling and in the production of the show.
You know, I'm okay if you say the show is about a mother caring for her child. That's fine.
I know, but then Aaron wouldn't be okay, and you two would have a big fight about it, and I don't know what would happen. What would you guys have to argue about then? It would be no fun to listen. I get so much joy out of this.
Coming out of the finale, I'm 99.1, like Red Arena's dead. We have to take it. Yeah, if we assume what we see on screen is what we see on screen, what are we going to argue about next year? And I think two of the listeners had really good questions, kind of coming off of Aaron's struggles with Liz's character and how it all played out with Red. Mm-hmm. Judy, I'm going to combine Judy and Chris's question here, because it seemed like Red was still a little bit perturbed when he was talking to Dembe right before Dembe leaves on his own path. He's like, Agent Keen has duped me one too many times. He doesn't call her Liz. He doesn't call her Masha. It says Agent Keen. So what is mm-hmm. the relationship of Red and Liz at the end of season 6? And how does that morph into season 7?
Wow, that's a good question. This is my read on it. I would say that I think we're leaving Liz on a high. She feels good. She has an answer. Remember, she doesn't know anything about Katerina she doesn't know that Red's been taken. So for her, her daughter's back. She has an answer that she feels good about with Reddington that adds up with everything she's seen. She knows about Dom. She's in a very positive place, I think. In terms of Reddington, I think he was perturbed that she went off and was asking questions. He would never have told her to go see Dom. He obviously kept that secret from her. Doesn't mean he lied to her, but he doesn't feel like it's her business. He's made very clear to dig into his past. And so I think Red's love for Liz melts the fact that he wants to be angry at her, right? As much as I want to be pissed at my kid because he does something that screws up, or my daughter, I can't stay angry. Now, that doesn't mean that Red has to be her father or Troy her mother, but his love for her is parental in that way. And so he carries on. Does he forgive her or not? I don't know if there is, like with Dembe, I don't know if there is forgiveness. They're more than that. But I think that Liz is in a positive place, feeling like she finally has the answers. And I think Red, in terms of Liz, is frustrated and guarded, as he always has been. He probably doesn't trust her just by virtue of the fact that she's an FBI agent, let alone anybody else there. And yet they are all, the whole task force, this weird, dysfunctional family in some way. And so where does that go? We have to get together in another week and figure that out.
You guys are going back to work in a week to break season 7 and talk about all that stuff, but you got 6 and 7 renewed at the same time. So I'm assuming that there was a general arc already uh-huh. out there yeah. for season 7 when you guys pitched it to NBC and the network and everything. Daniel Cerone is coming back for season 7, we hear. Is that like something that...
Yeah, look at you. How do you know that?
Cerone put it on Twitter. You got to be fans.
Look at Cerone with the spoilers.
Right.
Yeah.
So
he is coming back. Yeah.
Instrumental in the Kirk episode. So Katerina's back in the mix. Do we see Kirk again in season 7?
I don't know. I don't say that like being cagey about it. I'm not sure yet. I don't know enough about the story yet if we see Kirk. Look, Cerone is awesome. That guy is a fantastic writer. And we're lucky that he had a window in sort of the development. He also has a pilot that he might be doing as well. But we'll take what we can get. And to have him back, it's very cool. It shows, I mean, again, we've been on for so long. People have left the show, come back. It's pretty wild, but I'm happy to have him back. In terms of Kirk, I don't know. I'm not sure yet. And that's being very honest about, I'm not quite sure what the season holds. We are trying to surprise ourselves. He certainly could. I'll say that. I mean, he certainly could. Character is out there and obviously has a relationship with the other people who we've met. So he certainly could come back.
Are you going to surprise the audience with 7 with actually going to the flashback of the fire, the night of the fire, finally, now that Katerina's back in the picture?
Wow. Well, the only hard thing about fire is in New York City, they don't like fire a lot. So it's hard to do fire. Will we go back to the night of the fire? I don't know, Troy. That's interesting. I got to figure out. It's become sort of, ever since Knopf wrote that Cape May, we love going back each season and doing sort of a non-traditional episode. They're some of my favorites, actually, of the series. At some point, I'm sure at some point we will go back. I mean, the truth lies within the night of the fire. I'm sure that at some point we're going to have to go back there. I don't know that there's an episode around that. We sort of told an episode around that with the Kaplan episode. You know, that's as close as we got when, you know, we saw Katerina and Masha and there's the fires happening across town on TV. So that's as close as we've gotten. But yeah, that lies, that remains to be unmined territory.
Because it's been in every single, we want to call it flashback, if you will, because you had the Cape May and it's not the way he died, it's how he died and what he said when he died. And then you have, you know, a Requiem, you got the whole experience of them escaping from the house. And then you have the episode 19 this season, and you have them talk, well, we pulled Raymond's body out and, you know, we did everything we could. So it definitely seems like it's a linchpin. So be great to see.
Yeah, it is a linchpin. It's where the truth to the series lies not only within that night of the fire, but also the window, which we've started to color in quite a bit, what happened in the time after, right? Like the time after. One of the stories we told this season was Katerina walked into the water, but what happened after? And she walked out of the water. And so there is room there. There are stories there that have not yet been told that obviously we're being very careful with how what those stories are and how quickly we tell them. But yeah, there are some nuggets there that are yet to be revealed.
Nuggets that would be in that missing time period from, we used to say 1990 to 1994, but now we can say October of 91 to 94. Is that 3-year window just because the FBI doesn't ask really good questions in season 6?
Okay, that's a cheap shot. Wait, 91. What's your date in 91?
So the Kohler surgery happens in 91.
Yeah.
So like, is that 3-year period just the FBI doesn't catch up to him, or is that 3-year period actually stuff's taking place and we should actually still think about that 3-year period as important to the mythology?
It's, I got to be careful. It's both, Joy. The truth is on either side of that date. The truth of the show has its roots. It's not quite as simple as that. Those dates are benchmarks. And believe me, we went over them and over them. Sam Christopher, who wrote episode 18, she's the one who holds the Bible at the moment of all the dates. And my God, we went over it so everything tracks. And the dates do work. I don't think it's so specific as when Red went missing to the Kohler date to when Red reemerges as, yeah, it's not about a date. I'll say that.
Got it.
I just spoiled the whole show. I just gave it all away, didn't I?
That's why everybody's having such a hard time with the Ilya episode in 619. It's that you get this whole, like, Ilya comes up with this great plan. They talk about it, but then you don't see who's on the table. You don't see who's in the bank from a face forward side. You see him from the behind. So if you knew who that was, that's game over at that point. I think that's where people are like, well, what can I believe in that episode? Because clearly there was stuff hidden for a reason.
Well, again, this is me being tricky. Maybe. Or maybe it was. Maybe you just didn't see his face and Ilya is Ilya. You know, Ilya is Red. But you're right. I mean, it could be interpreted another way. It's the same thing with, you know, John and I were talking about this in an interview. Some of the conversation, we do this often. We've done this back to, I remember, in season 2 we did it, and I'm sure we did it before. Oftentimes these conversations, many times with Red, but with other characters, it can be interpreted, it's what's so fun about the show, can be interpreted in different ways, right? It's one conversation. Maybe it's on the surface, it appears to be one thing. Maybe you have a fan theory that influences it, makes it go another direction. But the subtext of the show is what the show is. And the idea that we can have characters having a conversation that can be interpreted in two different ways, I love that. And it's super hard to do, super hard to do. But you're pointing it out with the Ilya episode. I mean, maybe it's, as Aaron has said before, maybe what we saw is what we saw, and that is the truth. And it is a simple truth, and it is an answer, and it is concrete. Or the camp that you would take would say, well, I didn't see his face. I didn't see who was on the table. And maybe that was all very purposeful, and maybe you're both right. I'm being dodgy again, but it's what I love about the show. And what we work so hard to try to do is have double meanings.
Yeah. We always say a lexical ambiguity. And if that's the case, then it's what makes the Blacklist what the Blacklist is. And we're still going strong 7 seasons in and still bringing it every single week. And I think that's what fans want. They just want to know, is my show going to be there? Can I watch Spader do his thing? And can I just be entertained for 22 more episodes?
Yeah. Well, I certainly hope so. We are getting ready to dive in and just talk to Luke today. I talked to John today. We're going to be getting together again on June 3rd to dive in and figure it all out. It's a short break, but I know the season wasn't without flaws, but I think when it's at its best, it's really good. And I'm excited about what we have this season. And I know we have some really good stuff next season.
Well, as always, John, so much pleasure having you come on board, talk to the fans. It's always great to have you here. Thanks so much for stopping by once again. And hopefully we can do a little season 7 predictions in a couple months.
I would love it. And I just got to give a brief shout out to the fans. We wouldn't be doing that. We often talk about Schaumburg because you're in Schaumburg. We in the room go, oh man, what would the folks in Schaumburg think? What would the podcast fans think? I'm telling you, man, we've got the best fans in TV. I love the theories, and I love that they can look at the show in such a granular way. And that's largely possible because of the focus that you guys give it. So thanks for talking about the show each week. And thanks to the fans for digging what we're doing.
All right, that was it. I think you got everything you could have possibly wanted, except, you know, concrete answers. Everything else was probably pretty good. We really appreciate him coming on. He did answer quite a few things that, you know, he took some direct questions. He took some hits. You know what I'm saying?
Sure did.
I respect the man.
What's even better is that a bunch of people got this episode early because they go out to Patreon. That's Patreon, patreon.com/theblacklistGSM for their $5 donation. They got this episode early from everybody else. So if you want the episodes early come season 7, go on over to Patreon. That's patreon.com/theblacklistGSM.
Man, this is it, Troy. I mean, this is it. That's just the way it goes, right?
Are you nervous that 7 might be it?
No. I think as well, I mean, to reference that show that shall not be named again, I firmly believe it's very hard for a show to go past 7 years and still be on top. Not that The Blacklist could not do it. It absolutely could. I'm just saying, I feel like when you're steeped high in mythology, it's not like an NCIS. It's not like a Law and Order. You know, you kind of need an end game, and you need to start enacting that end game, and you have to do it on a timetable. Very much like Breaking Bad did. Breaking Bad knew when to pull the plug. And that makes a difference. So whatever they decide, I'm sure will be the best interest of the show. I'm not worried about it because I feel like if this is the final season, they have more than enough time to stick the landing.
I would agree with that. 22 episodes. Once again, season 7 coming back. Hopefully September 27th, worst case October, but it will be in the fall. So be sure to stick around and check it out on NBC or your station of choice, or just catch it on Netflix when all hits.
And we will be definitely covering, we'll be back the week before it returns, most likely, usually.
Yeah, we'll do our season 7 prediction show like we usually do, and maybe an interview from John, and who knows who else might stop by.
Okay. Yeah. So you definitely want to stay tuned. You definitely want to thank you for all your help on Patreon. You guys have kept the show going and growing, and we really, really do appreciate it. But for this year, or this season, not this year, we're coming back in the fall. For this season, that's going to conclude this episode and this season of The Blacklist Exposed. So be sure to follow us on Twitter at TheBlacklistGSM, where we live tweet whenever we can during the show, but also we're going to be tweeting any information we find or hear or rumors or whatever. We'll probably be dropping down there. So keep your eye on the Twitter feeds throughout the summer as well.
And don't forget to follow us on Tumblr, Instagram, and join the Facebook group and keep the conversations going all summer long. Talk about the podcast, talk about the show, talk about anything you want, what you did for the summer, and hey, maybe even if you bumped into anybody in New York when you went to go for a visit.
Beyond Westworld, if you want to catch up on Westworld before next year, Troy and I do that one as well.
All right, that'll do it for us. Thanks so much. We will talk to you again in the fall. Peace out.
Bye-bye.
Until next time, I'm Agent Troy Heinrichs. That's at Troy Heinrichs on Twitter. And if you want to learn more about me, just visit, well, about.me/Troy Heinrichs.
And I'm Agent Aaron Peterson. You can hear me talking about movies and TV on the Hollywood Outsider podcast, as well as Remake This Movie Right. We are available at thehollywoodoutsider.com or on Twitter at 5popcorn. Be sure to subscribe, download the app, submit your feedback, but most importantly, keep yourself off of
the Blacklist. The Blacklist Exposed is a Golden Spiral Media production. Find more of our great podcasts at goldenspiralmedia.com/podcasts.